Yay.
Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, we've already got people laughing. This is going to be a great show, I can tell you that. This is Dr. John Staney live from crisp, cool, and clear Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. It is beautiful out tonight, the perfect night for a scary cast, and it's going to be a lot of fun. And first of all, I want, in order of who showed up and said hello, first of all, the amazing Velvet. Velvet, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. I hope everybody else is too.
Heck, you better be doing great. You're one of our favorite people, and we're always glad to have you. And I'll tell you what, in honor of the fact that we've got one of the best wrestlers, one of the best indie wrestlers in the world, I want to introduce one of the greatest professional wrestlers in history, and one of my very close friends, Papa Stro, the maestro of wrestling. How are you doing, Papa Stro?
Oh, great to be here with you guys. You know, with all these doctors, I'm glad I'm not sick. That's wonderful. Great to be with you all.
Now, be nice. So we're going to talk about our doctors. So we've got the best doctor that we know. Dr. Trey Donaway. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing fine, John. Nice to be here.
Well,
I can't wait
to
hear from John LeMay again. I enjoyed him so much the last time he was here.
Heck yeah, and we're glad to have you back tonight so you can ask him some cool questions. And speaking of cool questions, we're going to talk to our boy from Hollywood, actually West Hollywood. How are you doing tonight?
I'm doing great, John. Just a little bummed out at a very low key Halloween weekend, but you know, it's all good.
Well, what do you mean, kind of low key? I mean, it's good when it is a little low key, I guess, after all the things that we've had. But we're so glad to have Devin Tate from Hollywood, and he's just a great guy.
You know what the vampire said about this weekend, right? This Halloween weekend.
They said
it sucked.
What did they say?
It sucked.
That it did.
Okay. Well, that's great. So I'm looking down here, making sure I haven't missed anybody, and maybe I did, maybe I didn't. But anyway, if I missed you, just let me know, and I'm glad to have everyone here on the one and only Scary Cast. So our guest tonight, John LeMay, the author, and he's got some great stories. He's got a lot of stuff to tell us about. So, John LeMay, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, and everything's great here in Roswell. The aliens are fine. They don't seem to catch the coronavirus, I guess, because they're not from Earth. I don't know.
They're interstellar, right? That's awesome.
Yeah.
Good for them.
There's something.
No aliens with coronavirus here in Roswell. No.
Well, we're
fantastic.
So glad to
nope.
have you.
Yeah.
And you've got a brand-new book out about aliens and cowboys. So tell us a little bit about that and how does that all work? Because I can't wait to hear about this.
The way you sounded, described it, it sounded like some bad erotic fiction, but it's actually a book about UFOology. It's completely nonfiction.
Yeah.
I'm just excited. All right. I'm going to turn it over to you because don't think that I'm trying to do any erotic fiction about UFOs and aliens. Okay, so go ahead. You take over right now, John.
Yeah. Well, the full title is it's book three in a series. It's The Real Cowboys and Aliens, The Coming of the Airships, 1896 to 1899.
Awesome.
Okay, well, then what are they about? Tell us about them.
Well, I guess I'll explain the first two books. me and my co-author Noe Torres, he's a ufologist in Edinburgh, Texas. We had only intended on doing like one book, and it's turned into like six books now. But as we dug through all these cases, we just kept finding more and more. So our first book was Early American UFOs, and that covered the years 1800 to 1864. We had stories about Lewis and Clark possibly running into a tribe of aliens out in the woods, and then we had Thomas Jefferson investigating a UFO sighting. It's all true stuff. It can all, you know, you can read the actual sources. And our second book was Old West UFOs, 1865 to 1895. And you might notice, again, book three is only 1896 to 1899, and that's because in most real serious Freudians and ufologists will know that 1896 and 1897 had just a huge wave of what they called airship sightings. There was one, well, to be honest, the highest density of them were in April, which is maybe dangerously close to April 1st, but they lasted well into the summer from spring, I think, to, I don't remember when they tapered off, but just all through 1896 to 1897, the newspapers were constantly reporting on airships, and it was crazy.
That's really interesting. What is now the one that I know about fairly well, because I've interviewed a couple of people about it. We're talking about the Aurora, Texas incident. Now, can you tell us about that? And is that part of this area of that you're talking about?
Yes, we got a big chapter on Aurora, and it was another one of those that occurred in April 17th, 1897. And Aurora is a very small town, from what I hear. I still haven't been there, but my co-author, Noe Torres, he's been there several times. And, you know, the story goes that they observed a cylindrical silvery airship kind of, I believe it was coasting through the air, if I remember right. It wasn't, like, streaking through the air real fast. It kind of coasted through the air, and it hit a windmill and crashed into the ground. And there were actually several different airship crashes in 1897, actually. Aurora wasn't the only one. It's just the most publicized. But in the wreckage, they found two things that were also common to the Roswell UFO crash from 1947. They found strange hieroglyphic writing, which happened in Roswell, and they found some sort of an alien body. And the problem is they didn't describe it. They just said that the pilot was not of this earth, and that they gave him a proper Christian burial in the cemetery. And unlike a lot of what some people might consider folklore, you know, very much unlike folklore, they actually have a Texas State historical marker at the Aurora Cemetery, and on that marker it does say that there's an alien pilot buried in the graveyard. And that's one of the only state historical markers to talk about UFOs or aliens. So very significant for that reason.
Now, John, when they buried the alien, is it a marked grave, or is it just somewhere in the graveyard there's the buried alien?
I'm glad you brought that up. So this alien has something in common with Billy the Kid. You know, Billy the Kid here in New Mexico, his tombstone was always getting stolen. Well, naturally, the alien's tombstone ended up stolen because
sure.
If it was out there today, you know, people would be looking at it. Supposedly, the tombstone had an etching on it of the spaceship, if I'm remembering that right. Yes, I've got it right here in front of me. There was a ufologist in 1973. His name was Bill Case, and he described the marker as having a drawing on it of a flying saucer with portholes. And it says here, Case used a metal detector over the spot and became excited when it indicated that large pieces of metal were also buried there, possibly alien wreckage, and he asked if he could exhume the grave, and of course he was denied. And the bad part of it is, after he published his story in a newspaper, thieves came along and stole the marker. Of course, maybe it was the Men in Black or the government, you know, no joke, it really could be. So now they don't really know where the pilot is buried in the cemetery because of the marker being stolen.
So when do you think approximately that it was stolen? Approximately what year do you think?
So it says he wrote the article in 1973, so that would have most likely that same year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well that was definitely the Men in Black, because they were they were out. How can I say it? They were out trying to get rid of every bit of evidence that, you know, could be had about, you know. Well, you know, what can I say? They were trying to get rid of every piece of evidence about UFOs and everything. I mean, you know, they were. I mean, you know, if you look at the just, you know, what went on with the Mothman, and that was about the time that they were, you know, going around trying to get rid of evidence or trying to frighten people into not talking about, you know, evidence about UFOs and everything. So, I mean, do you have anything else or any kind of other stories that you could tell us about that particular time?
About particularly Aurora
or like the 70s, yeah.
Well, I'll say this. You wouldn't believe how many Men in Black stories Noe and I have gathered from the Old West. And I think we'll actually have enough material for an entire book, as silly as this sounds, an entire book on Men in Black and the Old West. And something that people have got to realize, if you've only seen Men in Black in the movies with Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones, it's not precisely like that. It's kind of close to the truth, but most people who have really been involved with the Men in Black have a strange, sometimes demonic, supernatural quality to them. They can kind of appear in a room as if by magic. They smell like sulfur. Sometimes they have glowing eyes. They're really a lot more like ghosts. And there's definitely a lot of ghost stories from the Old West about Men in Black terrorizing people, but Noe and I have found almost a dozen stories about Men in Black in conjunction with UFOs. So there's definitely an interesting case to be made for that connection all the way back then. In fact, the chapter that follows Aurora in the book, because we go chronologically by date, on April 20th, in Homan, Arkansas, just 3 days after the Aurora crash, an airship visited that town, and it was actually piloted by Men in Black.
Now, John, this is Trey Dunaway again. When these sightings were made, I know airships, lighter-than-air airships, were in use in the 19th century. Did these look like, what are they called, dirigibles, or Zeppelins were a little bit later, but did it look like a non-rigid or a rigid airship from the descriptions? Could it have been of this world, but just they're not used to seeing that in the West, in these towns where these sightings are made? What do you think?
Excellent point. No, excellent point, and I'm glad you brought that up. So, most of the airship encounters are just that. They're dirigibles that do seem a little more advanced than they should be for the late 1890s. Now, there's very few that resemble an exact flying saucer. There was only, in fact, as far as flying saucers go, I'm trying to find the year that someone actually saw a flying saucer back in the pioneer days. And I'll have it just here in a second. A farmer just outside of Dallas, Texas, he saw what he described as a flying saucer. He literally used that term, flying saucer, in 1878. So that's our first instance of an actual flying saucer. But, yeah, as you said, back then, airships typically were like dirigibles. And let's see, in the case of this one from Arkansas, it doesn't look like a traditional dirigible because they've got a sketch of it. It looks more like something out of a Jules Verne sci-fi novel. It's kind of cylindrical, and it's got these odd sails on it. So definitely not a typical dirigible, but definitely more of an airship than a UFO, because, of course, UFO, as the term wasn't coined until, I think, what was it, the 1940s probably?
Mm-hmm.
And what's more, too, talking about how normal they look, almost always, too, the pilots were humans. They weren't aliens.
Right.
Like the cases of aliens were very rare, and Aurora was the case of an alien as well. Although I've actually had someone tell me that in the case of the Aurora alien, that what he was actually an illegal alien from a European nation that was supposedly flying over and scouting, I believe, the railroad tracks, and he was in a dirigible and crashed. And when he crashed, you know, his body burnt up, and when the body burns up, it shrivels because it loses all the moisture. And somebody tried to make the point that the reason why they thought the Aurora alien was from outer space was he was just a human being kind of burned beyond recognition, and who had also kind of shrunk a little bit. So that's an interesting
theory.
As we say
in medical parlance, that would be a crispy critter.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Now, do you think, though, that cowboys back then, having never, maybe they just never seen a body burnt badly in a fire before, but you would think if someone had seen a body burnt in a fire before, they might identify it as a human. But do you think people could actually see a burned body who are kind of uneducated and think, maybe that's an alien? Does that sound plausible to you?
I wouldn't think so. I think a burned body looks like a burned body, and it doesn't matter if it was in the 19th century or the 21st century. I mean, depends on the degree of burning. I mean, we haven't changed in 100 years, so I wouldn't think they'd, unless maybe there was some kind of a deformity that the individual would have when burned would be strange to see. But I think a burned body would look like a burned body.
Well, and I'm glad you said that, because skeptics will make up some crazy, crazy things. Skeptics make up the dumbest stories, like how Roswell was a weather balloon, and the aliens were really just test dummies. And you have to ask, well, were the witnesses really that dumb to mistake test dummies for aliens?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's kind of another example of a skeptic trying really hard to explain it as anything but an alien.
Right. In your point of view, during that time, do you think, I mean, just in your point of view, do you think the encounters were, any encounters like were confrontational, peaceful, or per se there was like some bartering going on, trade-offs with research, construction, manpower, like as you alluded to earlier with humans, with the airships and everything? I mean, what's your point of view on all that?
Well, my co-author, Noe, has a really interesting point of view. He has a whole chapter. Because Noe and I, it's like I'll write a chapter, Noe will write his chapters, and Noe wrote a whole chapter on how he thinks that maybe the airship pilots were time travelers, and as opposed to flying around in airplanes and things, you know, identifiable to the 20th century, Noe made an interesting argument that perhaps these time travelers traveled around in dirigibles because they were, you know, basically technology of the time, and that would be a way to disguise themselves. And so Noe has an interesting case that they're really just time travelers, and some people think they were aliens who shape-shifted to appear human, so they wouldn't be quite so frightening, although we do have a few stories we found where the airship pilots were definitely alien-looking. Now, but in terms of bartering and trade-off and technology, I don't know what to say. And I wish Noe was on here with me. Sometime we'll have to get him on, because he also wrote an interesting chapter on Nikola Tesla and the airships and kind of some connections he had to airships and comments that he made about them. And
I think it's interesting that you had that cluster in the 1890s, you know, because Jules Verne had been around for, I think he died the beginning of the 20th century. So that would have been
kind of when he had produced a lot of novels. He had Around the World in 80 Days. That was like in the 1870s or maybe 1880s. I don't remember. But it was that was an earlier novel of his. So you'd have that fiction writing going on, and you just I'm kind of a skeptic about UFOs, but yet there's some things I can't explain without saying, well, it's especially with the lights that go so fast in different directions that it defies physics, the aircraft that we have today. But I'm always looking for that edge where you find some definite proof of something, but it always seems to escape me a little bit.
Well, and
so
I'm glad you brought up Jules Verne.
You know, how much,
oh, no, go ahead.
How much Jules Verne-ism is involved in people seeing things and then running with a story that maybe was based on some fiction that they had read.
Yeah, I've run across two stories that really remind me of Jules Verne. And one, you know, there are UFOs and there are USOs, unidentified submersible objects.
Mm-hmm.
And we found a story from 1893 from Tacoma, Washington, about this strange, it was almost like a monster submarine, kind of sort of similar to Jules Verne's, you know, 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea of the Nautilus, which I think was published in 1869 or somewhere thereabouts. So. So
right.
That, you know, story definitely could have influenced that, assuming that it was a hoax. And I also found, we'll go from UFOs to dinosaurs now, remnant dinosaurs. I found another story from Arkansas that was very, it was way too similar to Journey to the Center of the Earth. You know, one of the trademark scenes of Journey to the Center of the Earth is when they actually get there and they find the prehistoric ocean. And they go sailing on it, and the plesiosaurs come out of the water and attack them. So there was a very similar story where these men go spelunking in an underground river system in Arkansas, and they built a raft within the underground river, and they go through the underground river and just happen to run into a plesiosaur, which I think is just much too fantastic of a story. But as always, these things are so weird. You know, I can't always confirm that the witnesses were real in these stories, but what I found so strange was that the witness from the story with the plesiosaur, he was real. He was in Arkansas on business to buy cattle, and all of these things confirmed. So he was at least a real man. You know, did he see a plesiosaur? Who knows? You know, we can't really prove that, but that's the fun thing about researching old articles is can you prove that the witness exists? Proving their character is very difficult because an argument that I think a lot of people always like to make is, well, they were respected men within the community and they wouldn't lie. My take on that is I know plenty of respectable men that will lie to make a good-natured joke. So, you know, to
right.
them, a story about I shot a dinosaur, that's not like a malicious lie that would ruin anybody. That's just a funny story. So I never
a tall
ever,
tale.
Yeah, exactly. So I never look at them as being respectable men as making the story count. But, I mean, you know, it helps, I guess, but...
Now, I guess that's where motivation comes in. If someone is motivated to, perpetrate a hoax just for fun or to tell a funny story that gets legs of its own and becomes more legend than the original fiction it was intended for, and 100 or so years later, it's really tough to track that motive down from anybody because obviously, they're long gone.
Exactly.
It's a challenge. It's a challenge to try to sort the fact from the fiction and the exaggeration from bits of real evidence.
Yep.
John, in your research, what's the most convincing or the I guess the story that rings true, of course, but isn't that what they always say about a good hoax? It has to ring true, and then you just twist it a little bit to make it wherever you're trying to drive that. But what's the one thing that the motivation is not obvious that someone did something for a hoax? What's your most convincing cowboy and alien encounter that you've researched?
Well, there again, it's one of the craziest ones. It was an encounter from Crawfordsville, Indiana. And it's not the only one, but it's just the first one that came to mind. I'm trying to thumb through the book and find the exact names of these witnesses. If you'll just bear with me for just a moment, I'm almost there. So Crawfordsville, Indiana, September 5th, 1891. They saw this strange, it really wasn't a UFO, it was, we're really getting into the fringes now. So in addition to UFOs, sometimes we have these things called atmospheric beasts, which are these unidentified animals that some people believe live in our atmosphere and have never been classified. But this strange creature they saw in Crawfordsville, it looked like a bunch of birds kind of like tightly amassed together. It looked like a feathered creature with a giant flaming red eye in its center. And a lot of different people throughout the town saw it over the course of, I believe, like two nights. I'm kind of going off of memory here. But the thing about it was, the primary witness was a Reverend George W. Switzer. And again, we could say no big deal. He's a reverend. But he was the key witness. And he also, later in life, was kind of notable for helping to, I believe he helped solve a murder later in life. So the Reverend Switzer, you know, he's pretty credible as far as witnesses go. And everybody in the town pretty much agreed that they had seen a monster. So, you know, that's another one where sometimes the most far out stories have the most credibility to them.
And did he have a plausible explanation? Did he? You know, I would tend to believe someone who would say, well, I thought maybe it was this, but it didn't have this factor and didn't have that factor, so I really can't explain it. To me, that would be more plausible than someone saying, well, I know it's not this and that because there's some made up reason. So, but I would think a minister would be respecting his community. I don't know what motive he'd have for making something up. And if it was witnessed by multiple people, that would certainly lend credence to a real sighting of something that was unexplained.
Yeah, and some people, there were two witnesses who said that they thought it was just a giant flock of birds, but that was just those two. And it doesn't really account for the big red flaming eye in the center of it. That's the phenomena that can't be explained. Otherwise, it kind of does sound like a big flock of birds. So, you know, these cases are just maddening because you've got about 50%, you know, 50% worth of information where it's like, yeah, it sounds like it really was a monster. And then you've got your other 50% where it's like, well, you know, it could just be this. And it's always just so impossible to say.
It sounds like an election where about half the people think one thing and the other half of the people think something else.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
It's been that
mm-hmm.
way for
mm-hmm.
hundreds of years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's kind of an interesting thing, Trey. It really is. Anyway, please go ahead.
Well, I think when we hear of the most recent UFOs, and it's like, again, 100 years from now, people will say, well, you know, in the early 21st century, there was a wide release of photo documentation from the U.S. Navy and from military sources, and there was this big uptick in UFO information. And then you've got Navy pilots who are credible witnesses who have seen things in the air that were unexplainable, and I wonder if it'll... I wonder if we'll be part of that record of history as you are studying cowboys and UFOs. There'll be a chapter 100 years from now that'll talk about UFOs in the U.S. Navy and the sightings and the information that was released. So it does come out cyclic. One question I've always had is, okay, let's just assume there are indeed UFOs. The government knows they're UFOs. Why would the government try to suppress that fact, assuming the truth will eventually come out? So what is the motivation for a government to say, no, there's no such thing as a UFO? And what's the motivation for the government to now release footage from naval flights that say, well, you know, it certainly looks like it could be a UFO? So from a motivational perspective, what does the government have in favor or disfavor of releasing information that might lead more people to believe or not believe in a UFO?
Boy, that's such a loaded question. I'm just going to go ahead and out myself a little bit. John talked earlier about Mothman, which, you know, Mothman
right.
was investigated by John Keel. And John Keel, I promise I'm going to get to the point, but John Keel, he investigated so many strange things, from demons to Men in Black to Bigfoot to Mothman, and he kind of noticed they were all connected. And he was one of the few researchers to connect those dots and draw parallels between them and say that all these strange things are connected. And so that's why when you tend to believe in all these things and believe they're all connected, they call you a Keelian or sort of a demonologist. So I have definitely come to believe that the aliens and the UFOs are more in the realm of evil things, because a lot of them do have a spiritual connotation. You can even trace it all the way back to old-time fairy lore. Old-time fairy lore is very similar to the UFOs. So let's say that the government did have some sort of a deal with UFOs. I would say it would be adjacent to a deal with the devil. So, I mean, that would be more my reasoning as to why they don't want people to know about UFOs, as opposed to just, oh, they're just, you know, aliens and visitors from other planets. That would be more my perspective, is there's something evil or something bad. And now as to why are they finally releasing that information now, I had an interesting conversation with somebody about that, and I said maybe they're doing it now while everyone is just so distracted with coronavirus and the election. You know, people are too distracted by that to even worry about the UFOs, that, you know, the information that's been released, and that way the government can say that, well, yes, we did release that information. You just didn't notice. You were so preoccupied. That was my take on it. But the person I was talking to, they said, well, I would argue the exact opposite. They said, with the election and with the coronavirus, more people than ever are currently glued to the news and are guaranteed to see this stuff. So their take on it was, the reason that they're putting it out now is everybody is watching. So I don't know which one is true.
Or the fact that we're aligned with the 24-hour news cycles, where, you know, there has to be a steady stream of information about
mm-hmm.
something in order to sell
yeah.
airtime, and this is just another exploitation of people that want to read articles about UFOs, because certainly it is fascinating. It's as fascinating for us now and a little bit after 2017 as it was in 1917, when they had all those the English girls who set up photographs with fairies, created a big hoax that was just swept the world cuttingly fairy hoax of 1917, where they showed the little girls with the fairies, that they were hoaxed photographs. It's a fascinating area. It's a fascinating area of research, because again, it's when you're dealing with implausible or unlikely, but yet you tie it into plausible sources, and I got to hand it to you, John, to sift through all this information and come up with a solution. I would think would be almost impossible after 100 years. I mean, it's hard enough to figure out what, you know, the guy down the street said about seeing a UFO last weekend compared to things that happened over a century ago.
Yeah, and something I try really hard to do is not act like I think I believe every case. I've got to prove every case was right. I don't try to do that. I think you look like a bad researcher if you act like every single case had to be true. It seems
right.
more like
because you know
agenda,
there has
you know,
to be false
yeah.
reports. I mean, it's just human
Absolutely.
Nature to figure mm-hmm. out somebody's going to be just having fun with you, or for whatever motivation they might have, just to mess with you. So I would agree. If you only have positives, well, if there's no false positives, then it's not an accurate representation of reality.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, so I believe in general in all of it. You know, the remnant dinosaurs, the strange things in the sky. I don't believe all of them, though, especially because yellow journalism and fake news back then was so much more rampant than, or it was a different thing than fake news today. You know, fake news back then was just entertainment most of the time. You know, so
right.
making up a story about aliens or dinosaurs, it was just good-natured entertainment to, you know, keep people reading the papers.
Heck, you can imagine 100 years from now, if people took The Onion seriously, they'd say, man, they were really messed up in the late 20th, early 21st
yeah.
century.
Now, actually, I do have a really neat story for you guys about fake news, yellow journalism with a political slant back in, I believe, when was the Spanish-American War? 1898, does that sound right?
Yeah, or 1901
yeah,
or something. I can pull it up. But you keep talking, I'll pull
yeah.
it up.
Okay, sounds good. You'll fact check me. And yeah, so I found a story, actually several stories about airships involved in the Spanish-American War. Actually, it was before the key thing to take away from this story is the airship sightings all took place before America joined in the conflict with Spain down in Cuba, because Cuba, I think at the time, was under the rule of Spain, and the Cubans were revolting and trying to get their independence. And the media, the newspapers, all felt like the U.S. should get involved in the war, and they were trying to pressure President McKinley to finally involve the U.S. in the war, and a lot of businessmen were advising McKinley against that. They said the U.S.'s economy is great right now. Don't mess it up by getting into a war. But again, the papers just kept really hammering McKinley and trying to get him to join in the war. And where the airships come into this, again, this was before the U.S. joined into the conflict. There were all these sightings of airships, and they would land. I think about six stories like this. The airship would land. The pilots were always human. You know, let's say a farmer would see them land out in his field. He would go and talk to the pilots, and the pilots would always tell him, yeah, we're on our way to Cuba to aid in the revolution. And I thought, well, that's really odd. Why would they care? And but anyways, I learned later on that these stories about airships being bound for Cuba were in their own funny, odd way just made up propaganda to try and, again, pressure the U.S. into thinking, oh, we should go help them. We should be involved in that war. And that's all the airship stories were. So it's kind of funny to think that these old-timey UFOs were used in propaganda stories. And if I understand,
it actually makes sense.
Yeah.
It makes sense with your range of dates, because if the peak was between 1896 and 1899, Spanish American War, the dates I have are April 21st, 1898 to December 10th, 1898. So it happens smack in the middle of 1898, which puts you right in the middle of your date range. So that would all coalesce to say, well,
so
I'm going to
say these stories were 1897 then. Yeah, I'm going to say these stories were 1897, then right before the U.S. finally caved and got involved. And I don't even, that was 100 years ago. I don't know whether the U.S. should have been involved or not. I just know the UFO aspect of the story. And but what ended up happening was McKinley finally sent a ship, I think it was the USS Maine, into the Havana Harbor. And it had quite possibly an ammunition malfunction in its hull, and it exploded from the inside, is what a lot of people believe. And the USS Maine sunk. And they actually haven't proved it, what happened to it to this day, but everybody the more knowledgeable people seem to think that it exploded from the inside. But the media, when they got a hold of that story, they reported it as though Spain had sunk the Maine and now we have to go to war. And, of course, the American people became enraged and was like, well, why aren't we in this war if Spain attacked our ship? And it, so that's, you know, a classic example of over 100 years ago, the media influencing and manipulating public opinion. So it was going on all the way back then.
I think it always had. Yeah, the mysterious destruction of the U.S. battleship Maine in Havana's harbor led to a declaration of war against Spain 2 months later. And I think they've done some marine archaeology on that, and I don't remember which way it went. But, you know, that was a sentinel bell for the United States for that war. And, in fact, the one of the masts of the – of the Maine is at Arlington Cemetery with victims that are interred there. So it really was a huge deal. Remember the Maine was the war cry for that, whether or not it was truly attributable to Spanish aggression or if it was just politically happy accident that some people could make hay with and push us into a war. It's not the first time that misleading facts have led our country into war.
Yeah, and for any historians that might have heard that, keep in mind I'm going off of the cuff, off the top of my head from memory, so if I got anything wrong, it wasn't on purpose, and I wasn't trying to be misleading. It's just, again, totally from my memory. I've written like 25 books now that I've had published, and like this one we're talking about tonight, I think I wrote last year. It's just now coming out here in a couple of weeks, but it, you know, it's one of those things where I've kind of got to refresh my memory as I go, because it's hard. Once you get past the 12th book, it's really hard to keep them all straight.
I can imagine, John.
Yeah, exactly. And it's wonderful that you can at least even, you know, talk to us about it. And you know, we've got a couple of our panelists that haven't really said anything, and I want to like get them in. You know, Devin Tate and our wrestling guru from Charleston. You know, Devin, do you have any questions that you'd like to ask?
Thank you for giving me the floor here. And yeah, I was just curious. I know you have the Real Cowboys and Aliens series of books, mainly focused on UFOs or airships. But are there any other kind of, you talked about different, you know, strange things and dark evil things. And I know we talk about cryptids a lot on here. So I'm wondering if you have any stories about anything else, if they're included in those books or otherwise.
Yeah, so the sister series to this is Cowboys and Saurians, and Saurians is just an antiquated term for reptiles, basically. So, yeah, sister series is Cowboys and Saurians, which is all about the cryptids. And I also did a couple kids' books, actually, kind of like the old, if anybody knows who Daniel Cohen was, back in the 70s, he would write books on the paranormal for middle school-age kids. I've got some stuff like that, But in this, the alien books, you know, in terms of cryptids and this one, The Coming of the Airships, Noe and I included a story about an animal that sounds suspiciously like a chupacabra back in the Old West that was sighted in Hightower, Kentucky back in 1896. And chupacabras are something that I don't really think should be associated with UFOs. I think they're just animals of some sort. I think the whole UFO connection is a little misguided, but Noe and I, you know, we like to have some variety in our books, and we were saying, you know, we've got a lot of airship stories, and most people associate chupacabras with UFOs anyway, so we, you know, we've got one chupacabra story in there that's honestly not real exciting. It just looks, it was just a mystery animal that got these local farmers really excited. They got excited enough that they wanted to go out and hunt it down and kill it because they felt it was dangerous. But it looked like the chupacabras from Texas that were like those kind of odd hairless coyotes. That's exactly what they described. So we included that. That's about our only cryptid. and the book. And then we've also got some aliens. I'm sure this is one of the made-up stories, but there were some aliens that were kind of fish-like that were sighted at one point in 1896. They had gills, and they had a dorsal fin like a shark. Yeah, so we've got a few odd creatures, but it's mostly just airship sightings themselves in this newest book.
Well, I love that. I actually am a fan of UFO sighting stories and books, so I'm going to definitely check out your latest book here. And
thank you.
I just wondered if you have heard, speaking of reptilian, if you've heard the legend of the Los Angeles lizard people, because that's something John and I have done a lot of research on this year.
Oh,
oh
please.
For sure.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
Yes.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Yes. Yeah, okay, you can tell me more about this because I plan on covering them. Noe and I are up to the 1930s now. That's probably where we're going to quit. But I found a story that you can probably tell me more about an underground city of lizard people, like you said, I think in Los Angeles from the 1930s. Do you know anything like dating back that far?
Yeah, I believe those are the dates, actually, back in the 30s, because it was kind of the
awesome.
Same time as the Depression. Well, this is when it was getting some publicity, because it's when they did a dig. They actually, the county and the city let this crew dig to try to find the tunnels back in that time in the 30s. So, but the story itself is even older than that, but that is one critical part of the legend.
Well, I'm glad it's fairly well known, because I stumbled across that just trying to find material for our book on, you know, Depression era UFOs, and that was something that definitely caught my eye. So I'll have to get with you on that before we finish that chapter.
Oh yeah, that'd be great. I'd love to. I'll talk your ear off about it.
Okay, great.
And I can tell you that Devin did a great. A great video about that, and we had it on the Lizard Man Festival website, and it was really wonderful. So yeah, absolutely, all three of us need to get together, because I think there's something there. I really do, and based on some I just think there's a lot there that really could be, you know, moved forward. So, yeah, we can talk about that, and that'll be great. And so now, the incredible Velvet, the amazing Velvet, one of our great wrestlers, I'm sure he's got a question or two to ask to you, John.
Yes. Going back to UFOs and sightings in the 1800s, you brought us up to a point in the 1900s. I want to know, wasn't there a sighting in World War II towards the end of the war, I believe, by a German airman that saw something by the end of the war? Did you have any... did you do any history on that or research on that?
No. We wanted to cover what had mostly been ignored, and the 1940s has been covered really well. And I'm guessing you're talking about what they called the Foo Fighters, just like the band that's popular today. The Foo Fighters is what the German pilots, I think, called the strange UFOs that they saw. And I think there were quite a few sightings of that.
Yeah, there was one that it was a red dot, supposedly described as a red dot, that could zigzag and turn on a dime. Maybe that is what that was.
I'm not sure.
Okay. I thought that was pretty interesting. I had heard stories of that mentioned. My father was in World War II, and he mentioned it one time when we were kids, and that always stuck out in my mind, being that we lost a brother in the Pacific, and my father was scheduled to go to the Pacific at that time, at that kind of time frame, but he never went. But yeah, I think that's what, because it was kind of hush-hush you know, everybody would, they would talk about it in only certain circles, you know, like my uncles and stuff, and, you know, you'd overhear stuff, but really not paying attention to it, as, you know, as a kid, you didn't know what they were really talking about. But I do remember before my father died, he was telling all kind of stories, I mean, about the war that we had never heard, you know, and that was one of them that he believed that that actually happened. So, I mean,
yeah,
I don't
there's,
know.
There's some people, yeah, think that the Nazis reverse engineered UFOs too, which they, I think they have the drawings for it and everything, that there's pretty good evidence that they were at least attempting to create UFOs as well.
Okay, that's
exactly
interesting. Well, that helped me out.
Yeah.
That was
well,
good.
Well, thanks, Harold. I mean, that's kind of a neat perspective, and that's something that I do want to talk with John LeMay about later on. It's like sometimes I hear some things tonight that are just kind of crazy, but they're not. They're
right.
Absolutely not. And the deal about Hawaii and all of the things that happened in Hawaii and all that. And I'd like to talk with him about, with John LeMay about this. And I think, these are things that happened in the 60s and 70s. And I don't know. So anyway, I want to turn it back over to John and, what do you have to say?
Well, I've actually got a funny story since you've got a couple of wrestlers on here. It's not exactly a wrestling match with an alien, but there was a farmer who got in a fight with an alien. I'm trying to find the date. On that one.
Oh, this sounds great.
What was it? Yeah. So this farmer, according to the story, this farmer, an alien had landed. He was a really tall alien, is what they said. Kind of tall and scary looking, but he still went up to him to shake his hand. And the alien took this as a threat. And the alien kicked the man. Let me find it. I'm looking for the story in my book. I've almost got it, so that way I don't bungle it.
Sure.
I think you always have to be pretty careful on your approach to an alien, you know?
Yes.
Really.
Well, this story is a testament to that. Okay, so it's an article from the Grand Rapids Evening Press, April 16th, 1897, just the day before the Aurora crash. It says, a strange airship swooped down from the sky, and a very tall alien clambered over the side as a group of local farmers moved briskly towards the ship, eager to discover more about the bizarre sight. As the farmers approached, the tall creature spoke to them eloquently in an unknown tongue, which elicited only puzzled looks from the farmers. I'm trying to find the part where the alien kicks them. Let's see. I'm trying to get to where we have exact quotations from the paper. Okay, here it is. One of the farmers hospitably extended his hand, but in the country the visitor comes from, this seems to be considered an affront. That's the paper's wording. The big fellow swung one of his legs, and the farmer retired in disorder with a broken hip. So the alien kicked the farmer and gave him a broken hip because he tried to shake his hand. And then he flew off in the spaceship, and that was that. So, got to be careful.
Yeah, especially if they're tall and they can kick
a filler.
They can kick a diameter.
In wrestling terms, that'd be a filler. That really wasn't.
Yeah,
much
I thought
that wrestling
would like that story. Yeah.
Now that would be something if they scheduled a wrestling match between the alien and the farmer.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
Who would want to referee that thing? Officiate it? My goodness.
Be out of this world.
Literally.
Only Dr. John would want to. Oh my God. That's unbelievable.
No, you wouldn't. No, you wouldn't. You couldn't even handle Bigfoot. Well, how do you think you can handle extraterrestrials?
Oh. No, you didn't.
Right. I don't know. If I couldn't handle Bigfoot, it would be an unbelievable. Yeah, I mean that's really interesting, John LeMay.
can you please?
I don't think Reese's Pieces would be a good try neither.
Yeah, can you please go through that again? That is so amazing.
It is.
If you don't mind, kind sir.
Oh, you want the details of that, the alien kick story again?
Yes.
Let me dig it up one more time just so I can get the dates right and repeat some of that again. It was printed in quite a few newspapers in late April, but I believe the first time it was printed was April 16th, 1897. And Noe wrote this chapter. Yeah, Noe compared this alien to the Canaanite from the Twilight Zone from the episode To Serve Man. That's what Noe felt like.
Oh, yeah.
You know, pretty scary.
Love that episode.
Yeah, and I found that, you know, that's the other thing about these stories is you find alternative versions of them. And I found an alternative version of the story in George Mitrovic's book, UFOs and Atlas History, where it says that the onlookers could see animal pelts sprung up inside of this UFO, which is an additional detail I didn't see anywhere else, which is interesting. And also the giant was a naked alien, which makes it even worse. And it says he made a series of bellowing noises and stood around for several hours after kicking the farmer.
I guess nobody else is going to approach him. Not within kick.
Not after that,
so.
No.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
Especially him being naked. God, I wouldn't either.
Yeah. Well, they had the decency back then not to, you know, report those details, but.
Right.
Hey, you know what? I've got more naked alien stories for you. I've got a good naked alien story for you.
Oh,
let me find the date on
that.
Oh, we've got to hear this. Absolutely, we've got to hear this.
Oh, yeah, yeah. You got to roll out the naked alien story. We don't want to miss that.
Well, so
that's
a
new Naked and Afraid episode.
So, okay.
Let's hear it now.
Okay, a lot of these sightings were interpreted religiously. And so this man described it as he felt like he was seeing Adam and Eve come out of an airship because he said they were both beautiful people that were perfect specimens, and they were both naked. So let me try and find some descriptions here. Let me see. So he says, I saw a sight.
We cannot wait. Are you ready?
I saw a sight that rooted me to the spot with amazement for some time. I could not believe my eyes at first and shook myself to see if I was not dreaming. There in the clearing rested a vessel similar in outline to the airship shown in the Post dispatch of a few days ago and was said to have been seen over Illinois. As the sun shone upon it, the rays were reflected as from burnished aluminum that rested upon four legs or supports, which raised it from the ground sufficiently to give room for two wheels like the propeller of a ship lying horizontally. And he goes on here to describe the ship. Now here's the girl. Near the vessel was the most beautiful being I ever beheld. She was rather under medium size, but of the most exquisite form and features such as would put to shame the forms as sculpted by the ancient Greeks. She was dressed in nature's garb, which that's fancy wording back then for being naked, and her golden hair, wavy and glossy, hung to her waist, unconfined, excepting by a band of glistening jewels that bound it back from her forehead. The jewels threw out rays of light as she moved her head. She was plucking little flowers that were just blossoming from the sod, with exclamations of delight and in a language I could not understand. Her voice was like low, silvery bells, and her laughter rang out like their chimes. And let's see. And then in the shade of the vessel lay a man of noble proportions and majestic countenance. His hair of dark auburn fell to his shoulders and wavy masses, and his full beard of the same color reached to his breast. Basically, he's just saying they were beautiful people, and he tries to talk to them, but they don't speak English, obviously, and he can't communicate with them. And They're very friendly to him, though, and take him aboard the airship and kind of show him around. And if I remember right, they offer to give him a ride, and he gets scared and he jumps out, and then they fly away. And that's the end of that
story.
But
they did not
kick
him. There was no kicking involved.
No, he was not kicked
this
time.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Mm-hmm.
No,
that would be encouraging. Yeah.
They were hippie aliens, apparently.
Watch the kick. Avoid the kick.
I would say that sounded more fiction than real.
Possibly,
but,
unless
you
want to argue they were the Nordic aliens, because the Nordic aliens kind of match that description, but they're usually clothed.
Are Nordic aliens usually clothed in like animal furs or warm things? Or
I don't recall. I don't recall.
See, I guess that would beg the question: well, how do non-naked aliens usually present? You know, what kind of outfits are they wearing?
That's a good point. We might have to ask Noe, my co-author, about that.
Yeah,
I can't even imagine going
some,
down a runway, fashion
if
runway.
Some, I would say if it's looking like it's fashion that's adjusted from the era of time that the episode happened, I think that would give credence to the fact that someone's being a little creative with the description of the clothed naked or the clothed aliens. But if you're unclothed, then you're just pure alien.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I wonder if they would speak Celtic if they being the Nordic aliens. That'd be interesting.
You know, you just jogged another story in my head. It's not in this book, because this book only goes to 1899. But the next book, there was actually a strange sighting airship, they would call it a flap of sightings, a flap of airship sightings in 1907. And the pilots in this case all spoke German. Every time they always spoke German. And whenever they would get out of the airships, they would go and pray near a body of water. And then they would tell the people as they got on their airships that they needed to pray as well. It's a very strange story. And then in the final sighting, they were doing some sort of strange fire ritual. So I don't have that book in front of me to look at, so I'm going by memory. So that'll be in book four, but it's a very odd story about German airship pilots who seem to worship the elements.
Wow. That's fascinating.
Wow. So that will be in book four, and we can talk about that later. John?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
That is amazing. I'm sorry. It is because it reminds me of some stories that I've got. Absolutely. Oh, my goodness. Okay, I'm sorry.
But
clothing
of aliens would never work. It would be just like Roddy did try to do with Roddy Dangerfield. Easy money. Giving him the regular guy look, it just wasn't happening. So, I can imagine the aliens would close anyway.
Yeah,
John.
Yeah, but
what do you think? We've had some wonderful opinions from our panelists. You have given us some great stories about aliens and everything. How do we kind of wrap this up? Because this has been absolutely one of the best. One of the best shows we've ever had. It really has been. So how would you like to wrap this up? And whatever, I don't know what to say. How would you like to wrap this up?
Well, this has been one of the best shows I've ever been on. And I'll just say, if anybody liked what they heard here, well, I guess I've done so many books that will probably appeal to people who like, you know, cryptozoology and UFOs and all that. Instead of just giving you a title of a book, you know, just type in John LeMay, that last name is LEMAY, on Amazon under books, and you should just get a bunch of results. And, you know, but if you like this series in particular, it's called The Real Cowboys and Aliens, and each one has a different subtitle. There's several of them now, but this newest one that we talked about tonight is not actually out yet. It'll be out on November 15th, and again, it's called The Real Cowboys and Aliens, The Coming of the Airships. So that's my plug for the evening.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you what, I want to let everyone know how I met you, because this is great. Because sometimes Facebook will just send you a list of people that, you know, you should know them and whatever. And I remember I said, "Hey, how's it going?" And you know what, buddy? After "Hey, how's it going?" you have been one of the most incredible guests that I have ever had. I believe this is your second time, and absolutely not at all your last time with us. But, you know, you've got great stories, and we'll talk more between now and your next appearance here, which will actually be in a month, because we have this little thing called Roswell, the fact that you're from Roswell and you talk about Roswell, and now you've been talking about aliens and the cowboys and all that. It's just been wonderful. So all I've got to say is thank you so much for everything that you bring to Scarycast, and we'll see you back in a month and all that. How does that sound?
I look forward to it, and thank you for having me.
All right, well, that's great. And I want to thank, of course, we've got great co-panelists. We've got Papa Stro, the Maestro of Wrestling. We've had Velvet, the amazing Velvet, has been on here. We've had my favorite surgeon, and he's been awesome. So we've had a lot of great panelists here. So we'll be back next week on Scarycast. And thanks to everybody for being on here. And I'd like to see, does anyone have anything they would like to promote between now and the fact that we'll say au revoir for tonight? Who's got something to promote?
More storylines.
Storylines, yes.
More storyline.
We
okay,
love you,
we'll
Dr.
have more
John Stamey. We love you, buddy.
Well, thank you very much, the amazing Velvet. I really appreciate that. And Papa Strav,
yeah.
and yes. Everybody. So we'll see you next week on the one and only Scarycast. And we may have some exciting announcements to make for next week. So we'll see you next time. Take care, everybody.
Good night, everybody.
Thank you, John.
Guys.
And thank you, John.
Enjoyed
it.
Yeah, John.
Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.